You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 149 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48
what
champion Seattle Seahawks.
Is this the Shaquem Griffin edition?
It is the Shaquem Griffin edition.
There we go.
It is definitely not a Super Bowl edition. Wow, your face just went blank. That doesn't translate on a podcast. Facial expressions.
Well, you know what edition it is not? Getting right into this week's beer. It's not the Hope Solo edition. It is the Hop Solo edition from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. We are drinking two separate beers from a multi-pack from Sierra Nevada that I got. I'm going to be drinking the Hop Solo Crystal Hop IPA, and you're going to be drinking the Sierra Nevada Sidecar, an orange IPA, ale brewed with orange peel.
It also, since you paid for it, was not a free solo. I was hoping you were putting down the microphone as a gesture of your, as an expression of your unhappiness with that comment. But sadly, you were just doing it to open the beers. I don't know. We have any toast this week.
Well, we have a toast.
What's that?
To menu madness.
Oh, it's underway. It is madness.
Is it madness?
No, not really.
There was a 50-50 vote today.
There was an almost exact dead split. And you know what?
What?
I was on the right side of it.
Crustos?
Yeah.
Oh, come on. I'm a little bit nervous about Crustos in the next round because I think I have Crustos going deep.
It wasn't a strong effort for Crustos, but I'm pretty sure I went 8 of 8 in the first day
really?
Of Menu Madness. The dream of a perfect bracket remains alive.
The Fit Bowl fared quite well.
No, the Fit Hit Bowl lost.
It lost, but it was like it was at 50% for a while.
It was like 52-48, I think.
That was a close one.
That was against, I believe, Pinto Bean Crisp Taco, I want to say.
The Chicken Crisp Taco, I'm pretty sure I picked to go through. But I'm just like, come on, people.
Look, we talked about it on the preview podcast, which if you haven't listened to it, it still holds up. You got to go check it out.
Oh, yeah. It'll hold up forever, honestly. decades from now, people will be loving the analysis of us trying to guess what the average Taco Time consumer would be interested in.
The average Taco Time consumer who votes in a Taco Time poll on Twitter.
And I think we were probably right.
I feel good about my analysis,
so far,
like I said.
Because the fish taco, right? What, there was one where it got destroyed. I think there was like a veggie thing going against the fish taco, and it was like 80-20.
The fish soft taco won, beating the veggie soft taco.
Yeah,
yes.
Because you were like, veggie is not going to fare well in this bowl.
Because it's nobody's second choice. You don't make friends with salad, and you don't make friends with the veggie soft taco. I'm sorry.
It seems as though a lot of people are getting crisp beef burrito versus Mexi fries in the final.
Yes.
Which just, I don't know how you make a choice there.
Exactly.
When it's crisp beef burrito versus Mexi fries in the final.
The real winner is all of us.
We all win.
Yeah.
And, well, unfortunately, if you have not filled out your Menu Madness bracket, it's too late. So for you, the real winner is going to be the friends that you made along the way.
So that the polls, the bracket will continue until next Tuesday, I believe, next Wednesday? Next Tuesday.
We have to do a special edition, Talkin' Taco Time.
A recap?
A recap edition.
100%. I mean, there could be a lot of special editions coming up lately.
Okay.
I mean,
depending on how many brackets Taco Time announces.
Yes. No, I'm not of Talking Taco Time. I meant in the unlikely event that the Huskies are selected for the men's basketball NCAA tournament.
I don't like it.
We should probably do a pod about that. All right. Well, look, while we're on the subject of brackets, searches for Seattle's best food, again, a topic we know well, are uniquely qualified. Let's get back to our search for Seattle's best ramen. To help us determine the second finalist in our search for Seattle's best ramen, we are pleased to welcome in Jesse, but you probably better know him on Twitter, is at the Axiomatician. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Jesse, you may have been the catalyst of this ramen bracket. Is that correct?
That is possibly true, yes.
I'm trying to think. So you on Seahawks Twitter University were the director of human resources?
Yes, but I have no idea what that means.
Well, for this one, you should have been the director of new studies.
Yes. That would have worked as well.
And we had to have you as the person who pushed us to do this ramen bracket. We had to have you on for one of the crucial semifinals to determine who will be meeting Suka Shinbo in the final next week.
And that's
very exciting.
And that impetus, by the way, going back to November of 2018, when are you going to tell me what their best ramen in Seattle is?
All the way back to 2018.
That's right. I have been wanting to know the best ramen in Seattle for many months now.
Well, and now you're going to get a chance to tell us what one of the best ramens in Seattle are. One of the ramens, actually, not in Seattle. We're going to call it the Greater Seattle Area. And that is Tokyo Ya Ramen, way down south in Federal Way, which is going up against the number 2 seed, Oink, right in Capitol Hill.
Yeah, 2-3 matchup here. And I think, I don't know how you guys felt, but I would say it started out certainly as difficult as those two seedings would imply.
Well, but before then, Jesse, we know that your ramen credentials are getting us to do this ramen bracket, but we need to hear your full ramen credentials from you.
Of course. So the short answer is that I have very few ramen credentials.
Wow.
What I will say is that I thought I had more and better credentials before I started listening to some of the other people that you had on, and then I realized that I was in fact mistaken.
Because you haven't traveled to Japan at any point.
Or lived in Japan for years.
No, exactly, that's it. I have been to Japan, and I ate ramen there like 2 times.
Oh, that's a pretty that's great that's ramen credentials.
That's essentially my credential. But what I lack in the way of credentials, I make up for in enthusiasm.
There we go.
Because I think that ramen is probably one of the single best things that a person can eat.
Well, I personally am impressed by your credentials. I've never been to Japan.
I know. It's funny we ask other people for their credentials. Our credentials are, we just declared ourselves.
That's why we're
experts.
Asking other people.
It was actually the one place that I ate at that really stands out in my memory was great because it was essentially like a self-serving kiosk. And there were probably like, if I had to guess, I'd probably say like around between 50 and 100 different selections. And it was in a language that I don't speak or read. So it was a lot of guesswork. But it was a really pretty cool experience.
Did you just say ramen kiosk?
Yes.
There's like ramen buffets in Japan?
There were people actually making the ramen behind the kiosk, of course. But all of the ordering was done by machine.
Like at Costco.
Kind of.
Very similar.
Yeah, that's not at all what I would describe it as.
They have kiosks. That was the joke.
Okay.
Oh, fine.
But yeah, that and enthusiasm. That's it.
All right. Well, that's all you need. So going into this matchup, had you been to either location, Tokyo Ya or Oink?
No, I had not been to either location before this last week.
So what was that? Last Thursday, the two of us met up to go to lunch at Oink.
Yes.
What were your takeaways from that meal?
It was very good. So I jotted down some notes after we went. Can I just get right into it?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So I had the shoyu ramen. It was, you know, something that I'm pretty fond of. I like it a lot. So I went ahead and used your guys' grading system. So I probably would say that the noodles were really good. I think that a lot of times ramen noodles can be, for my taste, at least a little bit too thick, and sometimes a little bit too al dente, a little bit chewier than I like. So I liked that these noodles were not too thick, and they were, I thought, really well cooked. So they did really well on that. I think the chashu was probably the highlight of this bowl of ramen. It was really flavorful, but the texture was not what you often encounter when you have kind of a fattier cut of meat. So it was really flavorful, but the texture was great. And I also really liked that it was like 2 or 3 smaller pieces instead of one giant piece or just like a bunch of tiny pieces.
Yeah, it makes it a lot easier with the smaller pieces. Also, yeah. Honestly, like the Oink ramen is a smaller bowl of ramen than some of the others that we've had.
Yes, definitely true. So the only thing that I wasn't incredibly impressed by was the broth. And it was, so what I experienced was that it didn't seem like it was super well mixed. It seemed like the flavor kind of changed a little bit or shifted as I got further down into the bottom of the bowl.
Interesting.
Which is not a huge complaint. It's just strange a little bit.
So we kind of mixed it up. I think both Kevin and I previously had done the show you, right?
Yeah, we had split the show you.
Which the show you advanced when we had it the first time. Who was it facing?
Suica.
That was facing Suica, which was not really a great bowl of ramen to me.
It was at that point my highest rated bowl of ramen.
That was the one that had like the little bits of meatball or whatever.
Yes, it was ground pork. Yes,
it had ground pork in it. It was basically like, to me, Suica was a non ramen restaurant trying to do ramen, but they weren't Tsukushinbo. So I think Oink, it was like NCAA tournament style. They had the very tough first round matchup, right? They barely got through, but this time we both went with the spicy Kateri, right?
We did, yes. Which we were advised by Stephen Wynn, who is the third Pelton brother on that episode. That's what he got and told us to get. So followed that advice.
And just flavor-wise is so completely different from the shoyu. Honestly, like I agree with your perception about the shoyu broth. And to me, it's a mark on Oink that, you know, like the base ramen broth is not an excellent broth. Mm-hmm. But the spicy Kateri is very flavorful.
That's weird. Yeah. I scored, by the way, the shoyu a 9 out of 10 on broth when we had it the first time. So it was the rest that I didn't like as much. But yeah, this was a different experience, as Stephen described it back before. It's it utilizes mala sauce, which is a Chinese sauce that is commonly found in hot pot and involves Sichuan peppers, so therefore, you know, is traditionally associated with the numbing feel that you get from Sichuan peppers. I don't know that I experienced that at all with this. I don't know what kind
of... Not a lot of numbing.
I don't know what kind of quantities there are actually in here, but, you know, it certainly kicked up the spice level. There was also sesame oil in here, which was something that I had mentioned that I liked about the broth at Suica when we went there. So all of that was quite up my alley. I gave this a 10 out of 10 on broth. I thought it was the best broth we've had.
Wow. 10 out of 10 on broth.
Yeah.
It's honestly like the spicy Kateri, it's just an interesting flavor. Like you can't even necessarily pinpoint it. And right. it might be that mala sauce that you're talking about. Okay. So Jesse.
Yes.
Tokyo Ya. You made the trip down to Federal Way. I'm guessing this was your first time there also, right?
It was. And I have to say it was worth it.
Wow.
Yeah. Definitely worth a bit of a drive.
How would you rate Tokyo Ya?
So what I had there was the, and I may not pronounce it right, the spicy negi. I hope that's right.
Yes. Well, we don't know. We've never been to Japan, but that's how we both pronounced it also.
Okay, cool. And I went there with my wife, and she had the miso tonkatsu. So I was able to try, I mostly had the first one, but I was able to try some of the miso as well. And I should say that miso is pretty much almost always what I get when I go to my standard ramen place. It's what I like the most. Flavor-wise, I feel like it's usually the best. And so what I have to say, honestly, it just seemed like in so many ways such a better experience. The noodles were, they were a little bit wavy, which is just an aesthetic thing, not a taste thing, which I really liked. But they were, I mean, in some ways just as good as, in other ways better than the noodles at Oink Ramen. The broth, I forgot to take any substantial notes. I just wrote down the number, and it was basically the highest rating that I gave to anything. The broth of the ramen that I had at Tokyo Ya was just phenomenal. It was probably the best broth in a ramen that I've had. As far as the chashu is concerned, so this was interesting because I'd never seen it broken up into multiple small pieces, and I have to say I did not like it. So it was the one thing that I didn't grade quite as highly as other things. It was cooked really well. It had a really good char on it, which I really appreciated. But because they were broken up into so many pieces, it wasn't wholly consistent. Like some of them were great and some of them were just okay, which was a little strange.
That checks out. What did your wife think of the miso?
She really liked it. I don't know if she intentionally or accidentally got hers spicier than mine, so it was pretty hot, but it was still really enjoyable.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that's what me and the famous cousin Katie did when we went there, is I got the spicy negi and she got the miso, and she was really disappointed in the miso.
Heated on the miso. Yeah. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But she had no spice in there at all, like no additional spice whatsoever. And I think that's what it might have been needing.
Yeah, I pretty much almost always get some kind of spice in my miso. It definitely makes it, it adds just enough of a kick to make it really better than what it is by itself.
So when I went back to Tokyo Ya Ramen, instead of getting the spicy negi, to mix it up a little bit, this time I got the Tan Tan Ramen, which I had enjoyed when I had that at Aloha Ramen. It was very different, I would say, at Tokyo Ya, where it's kind of more, instead of being a wholly different broth than, you know, the classic tonkatsu, it's more, I think, a variation on the tonkatsu. And so it tasted more basic, I'd say, than the one that I had at Aloha Ramen. And frankly, I found it pretty substantially inferior to the spicy negi.
So are you judging it basically the overall experience, or are you just judging this most recent trip?
I'm judging actually just the first trip.
Okay. You're basically throwing out the worst trip, just the best that it can be.
Yes.
Okay. This is strong competition between these two ramens. It's interesting to hear this because I feel like so much of what we're judging here, which maybe...
A flaw in the bracket.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a bracket, though, you know, like sometimes you're just going to have an off day and then you're gone, right?
Yeah, it's a one and done.
But a lot of it seems like it boils down to a spice and flavor level, where getting, like, in general, when we've gotten kind of the spicier, more flavorful ramens, they tend to do a fared much better. And then also which ramen you're getting. Like, honestly, the base ramen at a lot of these locations, what it would like to show you, has not necessarily been what I would consider the hit of the bracket.
No.
All of that said, Jesse, what is your pick to advance to the finals in the Peltoncast search for Seattle's best ramen between Oink and Tokyo Ya?
Yeah, so I'm going to engage in a little bit of controversy, I hope. It's not actually controversial, but I'm going to shy away from integers. I'm going to use decimals.
There we go.
I hope that's okay. Yeah. And that's, you know, Peltoncast math right there as well, you know. So noodles for Oink Ramen, I gave the noodles an 8.5. I gave the broth 7.5. And with chashu, I gave it a 9.
Wow.
For a total of 25 out of 30. For Tokyo Ya Ramen, I gave the noodles a 9, the broth a 9.5, and the chashu an 8. And that actually creates a non-integer, so I went ahead and took away 0.5 points because I had to go a long ways to get there.
Yep.
but that notwithstanding, it still edges out Wink with 26 out of 30.
Wow.
So yeah, Tokyo Ya. It was, and honestly, the experience there was also better. The one thing that I will say was really weird, and I don't know if you guys noticed this, the table where we were sat, the physical table was really high up, so the actual bowl of ramen was like closer to my chest than it should be on a normal table, which was kind of bizarre.
I've been at a bar both times, so I did not, in fact, notice that.
Okay. I've been to a lot of restaurants. I'm not unfamiliar with eating out in public.
Restaurant credentials.
It was very weird.
It is a good experience. It's, oh my God, this, I'm wavering right now. Oh, I'm vacillating, but.
Should I go then? If you're vacillating, just give you some more time to think about this.
No, I know what I'm picking.
Okay.
And for me, the bowl of ramen and Oink was just too good. Like, I mean, honestly, that broth was almost indescribable. Every bite was excellent. And I think it's probably a real competitor in the final round if we're doing just that versus the Tsukushinbo ramen.
Hopefully it is a real competitor.
Should it advance there? It could be the best bowl of ramen in Seattle. I think the chashu that you described, like, excellent piece of chashu. It was cooked so perfectly where it wasn't too fatty. It had like the right amount of char. It was flavorful. Everything about it was good. The whole presentation was great. Like, honestly, the restaurant itself is small. It's tough to sit in. It's like a weird experience, but that's kind of what you want for ramen. The Mrs. Fantasy Genius, when I went with her, got a warm green tea, and it came in a can that was warm, which was unlike basically anything I've ever seen.
I had the exact same experience, but with oolong tea, and it was bizarre but wonderful.
Yeah.
It really was.
And they gave you a paper cup?
Yeah, and it was like, I mean, I can deduce how they were able to make it warm, but at the time it was like, this is magic.
Yeah, I was like, oh no, we said the warm, oh. that was a very strange experience. But for me, it's Oink Ramen in this matchup between Tokyo and Ya and Oink. I think that bowl, when I compare them head to head, I'm basically having kind of similar types of things between the spicy negi and the spicy katori. And I think that the katori just barely edges it out.
So one of the interesting things about this is when I was reevaluating on the same scale, I ended up wildly different than the shoyu ramen on the non-broth categories too. I did not enjoy the noodles as much this time around. They got downgraded from an 8 to a 7. But the chashu, somehow I only scored it a 4 when we went the first time.
Wow.
I assume that's because of the fact that we were splitting a bowl, so I only got one of the two pieces. And I was like, this isn't enough. And then when I actually had my own bowl and had two of them, it seemed like a reasonable amount. So that upgraded from a 4 out of 10 to a 7 out of 10.
Wow, huge.
But
that's probably the exact same chashu.
No, I'm sure it is. I think it's all just perception. But the thing here is, like, that those to me are less important. The broth drives, to me, the score of a bowl of ramen. That's one of the things I've learned in this process. And given that this was the best broth I've encountered, to me, as much as I enjoyed Tokyo Ramen, this was an easy call for Oink to advance to the finals.
Wow, an easy call.
Yeah.
Who do you feel like is the favorite now going into the finals for you?
I think the Oink bowl of ramen is the best we've had during this. Now,
wow.
I'm going back to Tsukushinbo on Saturday with Third Pelton brother for the finals, Zach Whitman.
Wow.
So we'll see if Tsukushinbo can take down Oink. But at this point, I would say that Oink is the best bowl of ramen I've had.
Well, and Jesse, if I had the exact same two bowls of ramen that you had, I think I would have voted the exact same way.
Yeah, and to be fair to Oink, and I mentioned this to Kevin earlier, I was playing, because I felt like the comparison was a little bit unfair, given what I had at the two places. So I was planning on going back to Oink today to have what you guys had, but it was closed on Mondays.
Oh!
So I honestly, in an alternate reality where I would have had that bowl of ramen, this could have been a clean sweep.
But maybe, I mean, Tokyo Ya, again, like an excellent bowl of ramen there.
I mean, it's been a great discovery that, you know, there is like top tier ramen in Federal Way.
Yes.
Part of the reason that I feel like if these two were extremely close, I was probably going to lean Oink either way because I didn't want to go back to Federal Way again. I've argued with you that I've been to Los Angeles more times than I've been to Federal Way in the last 5 years.
Yeah, and I made the point when Jesse and I were at lunch that it would feel odd if the finals came down to a place that's only open for brunch on Saturday when they serve ramen, and like a place that's in Federal Way.
The most difficult bowl of ramen in Seattle to attain.
You would really make the people have to work for it.
Yeah, that's what we're about.
That's right.
Yeah, maybe you value it, you appreciate it more if you've worked for it.
What did you feel like was, for you, the best ramen in Seattle going into this bracket, Jesse?
So I didn't have a lot of experience. And it's funny, the one that I always go to is the one that I can't remember the name. It's the one that's a giant chain. There's like a location in West Seattle and Capitol Hill.
Kazuki.
Yeah, exactly. And it's fine. I mean, that's where I usually eat. That's where I usually get ramen. As far as satisfying that ramen craving goes, it does the job.
Yeah, Kazuki, it's a large location, so
yeah.
I feel like it would have been tough to be in the competition for Seattle's best ramen because of yes. just how many they have. And honestly, that's why I felt like I didn't shed any tears for Ramen Dambo that was knocked out in the last round, because it's an international company, right? It's not right. necessarily Seattle's best ramen mm-hmm. because it's amazing that they're in Seattle, but they're also hundreds of locations throughout the country. Oink, there is one of.
Yeah.
Tsukishinbo, there is yeah. one of. And that's why I'm excited to see those two compete with each other in the championship for the Peltoncast search for Seattle's best ramen.
And I think that's also true of Tokyo Ya Ramen as well, right?
Yep.
It's just a solo location. Well,
thank you so much for joining us. As Kevin, Jesse, at the Axiomotician. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
It doesn't really have a real pronunciation, so that's fine. It's an invented word. Go for it however you like.
As Kevin mentioned, next week we will be back with the final round, the championship game in the Peltoncast search for Seattle's best ramen. If you want to eat along, it is between Oink and Capitol Hill. Don't go on a Monday because it's not open. And Tsukishinbo in the ID. Don't go any other day besides Saturday because that's the only day that they have ramen.
Yes, and it for only a brunch.
And only for brunch. Don't go too early, though. You'll get very cold. With third Pelton brother, the decider, Zach Whitman, for that final round. Thank you so much for being here, Jesse.
Thank you for having me.
Whew. All right. Well, the competitors are set. And we're going to be settling this next week. It's all going down. And then you know what's happening after that.
We're searching for Seattle's best sandwich.
We are searching for Seattle's best sandwich.
I'm excited.
That soon. I mean, we're going to pick it up right away. You told me that we had to start eating sandwiches ASAP.
I mean, we've only got so long here. We've got less than 6 months.
Less than how many sandwiches? I guess we're going to eat a lot of sandwiches.
I mean, sandwiches is a really broad category. Like, we have to determine how we're going to define sandwiches, which...
Oh, God. That's,
that may be a podcast all its own.
We're going to need Nate Duncan for this.
No, really, we need Zach Harper for that one.
Oh, what is, does Harper like defining sandwiches?
He mostly likes saying that, you know, Pop-Tarts are empanadas. Things of that nature. That cereal is a soup. That's a Zach Harper specialty.
Okay.
So we could come up with a very strange definition of sandwiches if we actually invite him.
We're not going to be having Pop-Tarts part of...
Okay. Well, I mean, they're not Seattle local anyway, so...
Or hot dogs. Hot dogs are not going to be on the list. You're pro... We have to have this argument right now.
We don't have to have this argument right now, but I'm just saying, should we have Costco hot dog on the list? Yeah, we probably should.
Then we should do Seattle's best hot dog.
That's Costco's hot dog.
We don't need to review other hot dogs. We can just go have the Costco hot dog and enjoy ourselves.
Yeah, it's part of our search for Seattle's best sandwich.
No, it doesn't. The Costco $1.50 hot dog plus soda is not...
I don't like the tone you said that.
No, I'm just saying it's not in the same conversation as the Raging Cajun. Like, these are so completely different things. When we're having ramen, all ramen is basically the same. We're talking about slight variations. A Costco $1.50 hot dog plus soda is not in the same family as a Raging Cajun.
But is a chicken sandwich in the same category as a Raging Cajun?
Yes.
So what's the difference here?
We need regions.
But again, what's the difference?
The difference between a hot dog?
It's meat. Between bread.
Wait, so you're pro the hot dog is a sandwich?
I don't like it, but logic demands it.
It's a separate thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I've done some thinking about the rules. We'll get into that.
Wait, about the regions or whatever.
No, about the rules about the what rules. Qualifies as a sandwich.
Okay, do you agree that we should have regions though?
Probably.
Okay. Because, I mean, there's different...
But that's only for the bracket, which is way at the end of this.
Okay,
months
maybe,
away from
maybe
that.
Not for the bracket. But, like, we're basically talking about... Well, I'm so excited to talk sandwiches. God, sandwiches are good.
We don't have time to talk sandwiches today.
Really quick. Basically, the way that I view it is you have chicken sandwiches.
Yes.
You have cold deli sandwiches.
Yes.
You have warm deli sandwiches.
Okay.
And you have your banh mi's, things like that.
Banh mi is its own category?
How about other?
All right.
Can we throw that into an other?
Yes.
So those are like the four different types of sandwiches that we're going to be considering.
Okay.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah. And hot dog is another?
God, hot dog might be another. We can go, we can review. I don't know if we're going to have like standards or whatever. Various. I don't know how we would rate like the bun and the meat and the accoutrement.
I mean, I did that for the ramen bracket, but I don't think it's necessary for the sandwich. You just need an overall score.
Okay.
We didn't do that for burgers or burritos.
Okay. We can go, but I mean, like, what's the difference between a burger then and
That's part of what I've been thinking
we're
about.
Obviously not including burgers. We've already searched for Seattle's
best burgers.
Anything
that can qualify in its own category doesn't qualify, but because we're not going to
ever do hot dogs.
Its own
category is hot dog!
But we're never going to do a search for Seattle's best hot dog because we know
speak
already it's the Costco hot dog.
Yourself.
What
we're
going to
be doing, we're
contenders?
Like Tom Brady with these brackets. We're never quitting.
Does the Frankfurter even exist still anymore?
The Frankfurter? Yeah. There must be. There must be gourmet hot dogs. You know, okay, so if we could transition here for a second, the reason we're doing this on a Monday is, we've been doing it on Mondays quite a bit lately.
We have.
I'm going to be in Austin, Texas, Tuesday through Saturday. And do you know what my first meal in Texas is going to be?
Is it going to be Veracruz tacos?
The hot dog king of Austin.
Oh, is it? Wow.
It's at the event that I'm going to. It's catered by the hot dog king of Austin. And I'm like, I mean, I'm not eating those hot dogs.
I mean, it's the king of Austin.
Like, we're looking for the best sandwich, so.
Okay.
Anyway, next week I will be back with reviews of a lot of barbecue and a lot of tacos.
If it hadn't been for the fact that I just recently went to Charleston, I would be so envious of you. I'm still am, but that mitigates it a little bit.
Fucking Charleston.
Oh, no.
Shouts to everybody who made it that far.
Yes, I hope you did.
Oh my god. I'm gonna have a lot of barbecue and what are you, you're smiling so much. A lot of barbecue and taco talk.
I look forward to it.
I'm staying literally right next door to a taco truck that has like 900 reviews and 4.5 stars.
So it's like an average taco truck in Austin.
I'm just like, why don't I live right next door to a taco truck right now?
I mean, it's a good question.
Yeah.
Maybe you need to get the famous cousin Katie to open a taco truck.
That's actually a really good idea.
Isn't it?
That's really good.
I don't know if this is the right location. Her home is the right location for it, but that would put it basically next door.
I'd eat a lot of the tacos, although I would never pay for them.
No, it's very...
As you heard last week, Carcino rarely pays their debts.
It's true. It's a tough business model. Should we talk about sports?
Wow, we're getting into sports. All right.
I mean, we did spend 20 minutes talking about Rob.
Okay.
We start with the Mariners making news ahead of next week's season opening series in Japan. And the big news, in a complete non-surprise, that for the first time since 2008, Felix Hernandez will not be the opening day starter for the Mariners. Instead, Marco Gonzalez will get the ball to open the season against the A's in Japan, followed by Japanese import Yusei Kikuchi in the second game of that series.
Can you imagine not being the opening day starter in the year that the Mariners traded James Paxton in the offseason? Like, that would be one thing, but it is... Get ready for, like, a 1-6 season. Felix maybe has 12 starts, 6-plus ERA, and his career is over.
It just seems like there's no good ending at this point between the Mariners and Felix, because he's not, like, bowing away gracefully. He's not doing the Dirk Nowitzki at this point.
Well, he has to keep getting them checks, right? Like, how long is that deal for?
I believe this is the final season.
This is the final year?
Yes.
And this will be probably the last year of Felix Hernandez's career.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe he could transition to a relief role somewhere else.
Reborn,
I don't know.
Reborn as a reliever.
I don't think anyone's paying him. First off, no one's paying him $27 million, but I don't know if anyone's paying him to start games.
It's just, honestly, like, Felix will probably go to the Hall of Fame, right?
Yeah.
And it's just, like, I want to describe him as almost a cautionary tale. He will have never played a playoff game in his entire career. Like, unless for some reason he has a pretty good season and, like, maybe he's a long reliever or whatever, he gets traded to a contending team midway through this year. Like, that could happen, and Felix could potentially play in a playoff game, which, God forbid, one of the best pitchers of all time could play one playoff game. It's like a pitcher who, during his peak, was built for a one-game play-in, but...
It's a classic Mariners tale.
Just like, this is... Th- this is such a Mariner story.
Yeah, no, it is. Right? 100%.
Like, this is the most Mariner story ever, and it's a sad thing that had to happen to Felix. At the same time, he's also getting paid a lot of money.
Yes. The other news coming out of spring training, Kyle Seager will undergo surgery to repair a torn tendon in his left hand and will miss at least through the month of April. So,
it's going to be a long one.
It sure is. It's like, I was like, oh, the stories are Felix is upset that he's not the opening day starter and Kyle Seager is hurt. Like, this is like very on 2019 Mariners brand right now.
The takes they're going to, I don't even know what kind of takes we're going to have.
Well, yeah, we'll come up with something, but no, you should come up with something.
We'll dig deep for the takes. You know what? It's spring training right now. I'm working out the takes, driving to work, giving takes, just throwing them out there. That's what we're doing. That's what this is about.
Good. Yeah. I'm glad.
I'll start in Austin, setting some around.
You just like walk up to someone. I'll see
what the hot dog king of Austin has to say about some of my takes.
Strong feelings about the Mariners there.
I assume he's a baseball fan.
You know who? Well, yeah. Hot dogs, baseball. It makes sense. That's kind of where I thought you were pivoting. I didn't realize it was going to be to Austin. You know who has a better 2019 brand?
Who's that?
The Seattle Sounders, whose brand is winning games by multiple goals thus far. A 2-0 win on Saturday at home against the Colorado Rapids in a match where they got goals from both Kelvin Leerdam and Raul Ruidíaz in the first 10 minutes of action. Kelvin Leerdam scored goals in both games this season, and Ruidíaz now has scored in his last 7 matches for the Sounders, including both playoff games last year.
And I got offered tickets to this game and chose to watch the Husky basketball game instead.
Yeah, that was a huge mistake, aside from the temperature outside on Saturday night.
We discussed it last week, but very different than how they started last season when they needed 5 matches to get a win.
Yes.
Like, starting out 2-0 and getting 6 points, the MLS season is long.
And it's not been the most challenging competition, although I said to you earlier that they had played 2 of the worst teams in MLS, and you spoke up in defense of FC Cincinnati.
Always about defending the Natty.
And lo and behold, FC Cincinnati drew on the road at Atlanta United in their second game of the season, so that was an impressive result for them.
Look, we know that there are basically 2 MLS seasons that happen. This year might be slightly different because it is a little bit shorter.
I mean, it's still the same number of matches, though.
The same number of regular season matches.
Yes.
Playoff seeding will matter more this year.
Yes.
So,
all the more incentive for the Sounders to play better during the regular season than they have in the past.
Maybe if they could just start hot and then still get better throughout the year.
If they even start decently and still get better throughout the year.
I mean, they have 6 points.
Yeah, no, I mean,
they have the most points you could get and probably the best point differential in MLS.
That's right. Someone was calling us out for calling it the MLS, which, you know, it should be the MLS.
But it's not.
Which is why it's NLS in Men in Blazers parlance. Shouts to Mike Bay. Let's see. I did not look up their goal differential, but I'm assuming that it probably is the best in MLS. LAFC and Minnesota United are both +4. Sounders are +5. So, yes.
There we go.
Nobody in the East is better than +2. So again, a great start for the Sounders, who this Saturday will hit the road for the first time to face the Chicago Fire in a matinee, a 12 noon local time, 10 a.m. Pacific start to that one for the Sounders. Chicago has taken just 1 point from its first 2 matches, losing 2-1 on the road to the LA Galaxy and drawing 1-1 at home against Orlando City in that game. The Fire got the equalizer from CJ Sapong in the late stages of stoppage time to get the point. Sapong has scored both Fire goals this season. Chicago's a bottom 6 team in SPI, so this is a pretty good chance for the Sounders to get another result and keep this run going.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, obviously tougher on the road, but, you know.
It's 9 a.m. before daylight savings time, right?
Yes.
That is. But also, only the 3rd match of the season, they should be in pretty good form at this point, at least fitness-wise.
Yes, and they haven't been any midweek matches yet. They've been able to establish a nice routine of playing every weekend. The Seahawks saw the beginning of legal tampering period, the negotiating period ahead of free agency, which doesn't open officially until Wednesday.
Legal tampering.
But plenty of action nonetheless on Monday involving the Seahawks, all of it with players leaving them.
Hey.
Cornerback Justin Coleman agreed to a reported 4-year, $36 million deal, according to NFL Network's Ian Rappaport, with the Detroit Lions, that will make him the highest paid nickel corner in the NFL.
Probably in NFL history.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the price of nickel corners continues to increase.
There are probably somebody who played nickel corner.
Someone who was signed to play there. I mean, the one thing Bill Barnwell pointed out is perhaps they are in fact signing him to play as a boundary corner, but probably not. I don't know. Like, the Seahawks never really saw him in that role. They saw him exclusively as a nickel.
It's like, is this the 2014 NBA offseason and the salary cap went up, but just for the Detroit Lions? Did I have that year right?
No.
Okay, cool.
It was 2016.
Close enough. Like, is this Evan Turner? What happened? How did Justin Coleman get this contract from $9 million per year?
I mean, it's surprising, but I don't know if it's stunning. Like,
this isn't stunning to you?
Like, Coleman was considered one of the best nickel corners out there. It's a position that is gradually being more valued. And yes, teams are throwing around a lot of money today.
I was shocked. I did, you know, the face, is that Nick Young? The like,
yes.
Like, I literally did that face and I was like, oh, I just did that Nick Young face when I saw this. Like, that was an insane amount of money. Even if the value of nickel corners is going up, like, just use a higher draft pick. Come on, guys. But I mean, good for Justin Coleman. And it's not the type of signing where I look at it and I say to myself, oh, the Seahawks are crippled because they lost Justin Coleman. Like, they will find another nickel corner.
Yeah, I mean, the Seahawks have the right strategy here, which is, look, we were able to find Justin Coleman. We gave up a 7th-round pick to the Patriots at the end of the training camp to get him. We're going to develop someone else in the same way, and it looks like that will most likely be Akeem King, who saw a fair bit of playing time last year.
Or TBD. I mean, you know, like,
it could be someone
two
else.
Consecutive years, rookie cornerbacks have started for the Seahawks.
That is accurate. But they re-signed him as a restricted free agent, or ahead of his restricted free agency, to a 1-year deal worth up to $2.2 million last Friday. So, you know, he looks likely to get the first shot in that spot, I would say.
Okay.
Other moves involving the Seahawks. By the way, the other aspect of this in terms of Coleman making that much is its potential implications if the Seahawks can manage things correctly in terms of compensatory picks. And it seems like the early word is that, you know, $9 million with the inflation would now probably be worth a 4th-round comp pick.
Okay.
So
player, the comp picks are based upon how much a player is being paid.
But it's also based on whether you sign fewer qualifying players than you lose, and then players like cancel each other out. It's weird.
I don't really understand the process.
But I think the Seahawks are in a situation where they're probably not going to be really aggressive in terms of signing other teams' free agents.
No.
If they are strategic about it, sign players that were waived by other teams instead of qualifying free agents. And, you know, then let's, they're obviously going to have several free agents who leave. I think there is the opportunity this year to, you know, make good use of the comp system in a way that they did not do last year.
And so the compensatory picks would be for next year's draft, right?
Yes.
They can't get into this year's draft where they have 4 draft picks or whatever.
No, those are based on 2018 free agency.
So, but to me, the best strategy to have, looking at the money that is being thrown around in free agency, we'll talk more about this in a second, is to sit everything out.
I mean, I don't know about everything out, but here's
how you should build a roster. If you are an NFL football team and you have the quarterback, right? Like, if you have a team that is ready to be a playoff team.
You're saying otherwise you should spend $22 million a year on Nick Foles?
Yeah. Or no, I'm saying you should also sit everything out if you don't have a quarterback because you're not fucking winning anyway, so who cares? But if you're in the position that the Seahawks are in, the way that you should approach the offseason is to basically sign nobody who would equal a compensatory pick and maybe use 6th- and 7th-round draft picks to go out and trade for disgruntled players who are still pretty good.
Yes.
Or players that are waived. Like, this is the way to approach the offseason.
The way the Patriots do it.
Yeah, do it the way the Patriots do it.
Trading for Michael Bennett for a 5th-round pick and getting back a 7th.
If only.
Yeah, who can imagine such a deal?
But that is how to do it. Going out and signing players is basically never the right decision, especially in this market where players are seeming to be wildly overpaid.
And look, people are going to run out of money. The market will cool down eventually. Like, you always expect that it's going to start out.
Is like, wait until the very bitter end of free agency.
I mean, the reason that players agree to these deals right away is because of the fact that they're getting so much money that they're confident they can't get a better deal elsewhere. That's so, like, inevitably, by definition, deals on the first day are probably going to be bad values.
Well, I guess we should be very happy that the Seahawks have not engaged. The thing that was most shocking to me, though, was the safety market.
Yeah, I mean, it was a dramatic change from last season where safeties languished for an extended period of time and got very little in terms of, you know, annual salary or guaranteed money. And that changed pretty quickly with Landon Collins, to a lesser extent, Tyrann Mathieu. And all seems to bode very well for Earl Thomas and his chances of getting highly paid by the Houston Texans.
Oh, is that what the steam is?
That is the scuttle at this point.
Oh, good. I mean, they're closer to Austin, right?
Than Dallas?
This is some podcast geography here.
I mean, they're probably pretty close. The Texas Triangle is all pretty close to each other. And Austin is San Antonio is technically the third part of the triangle, but.
Which is definitely closer.
But that is closer to Austin, yes.
I like it. Yeah. Go play for the Texans, Earl. That'd be cool.
I have him in the AFC playing for a fun team. Like, I could root for the Texans, Deshaun Watson.
Yeah. Go to the Texans, Earl.
Yeah, we talked ourselves into this.
There we go.
Earl Thomas, noted Peltoncast listener.
also today, Shamar Stephen.
He returned to the Vikings. He rejoined Tom Johnson. What an amazing scenario.
Pretty incredible that the Seahawks signed last offseason two Vikings defensive linemen, and both of them have returned home.
They've found their calling. They found their true north. And meanwhile, Sheldon Richardson probably will not be back with the Vikings. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
He signed a 1-year deal?
He did.
And he's a free agent.
That is how it works.
Interesting.
He probably will not be coming back to the Seahawks, sadly. and then the other Seahawks free agent, a 3-year deal, by the way, for Shamar Stephen with the Vikings. So I guess that 1 year in Seattle, it really made the Vikings want him.
We'll always have that 1 year, Shamar.
Mike Davis signing with or agreeing to a 2-year deal with the Bears, worth, according to the aforementioned Ian Rappaport, up to $7 million total.
What was this deal? Like, I love Mike Davis. This is nothing personal against Mike Davis.
Absolutely not.
But he is pretty much the definition of replacement level. Like, also, aged running backs. Like, the Chiefs went out and signed Carlos Hyde, not for a lot of money, but what's happening?
The Bills signed Frank Gore because their running back rotation wasn't old enough.
Well, it's like the Bears already had three.
Apparently, they're planning to trade Jordan Howard. That's the scuttle.
So they need one garbage running back to run into the line all the time. Yeah. So Tariq Cohen could be good.
Yes.
And that other dude who stole a touchdown from Tariq Cohen.
I don't remember what his name is. No.
He was pretty good too, though. I can't remember what his name was, but he was a quality player.
Okay.
Yeah, I remember him playing. It's been.
But hey, good for a toast to Mike Davis.
No, love it.
And just Coleman.
Hey, good for Mike Davis. I'd rather have Mike Davis than Jordan Howard. I wouldn't necessarily rather have Mike Davis at how many million per year?
I mean, it's $7 million total over 2 years. It's not a huge number. It's just...
It's a huge number because he's basically like an off-the-street free agent caliber player.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a little harsh to Mike Davis, but the key is that running backs are highly replaceable.
Rank in the Seahawks depth chart?
Third. I mean, are you going to say behind McKissick?
If McKissick was healthy.
Maybe. I mean, McKissick is just, they see him in such a different role. It's tough to make that comparison. But that's also, you know, I think this can't come as a surprise to anyone that the Seahawks wouldn't match this with Chris Carson and... You know, the expectation that Penny plays a bigger role next season.
No, absolutely not. Good for Mike Davis.
Yeah.
I'm excited for everybody here. And I'm excited that Seahawks have not signed anybody because they shouldn't sign anybody.
Yeah, you're excited that NFC teams are overpaying here?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. That is good.
I mean, like, so far, this has been a pretty good offseason for the Seahawks.
The one big looming concern, Frank Clark. Is in a very confusing tweet, as Ben B was parsing the semantics there, which
I read it and I was like, it's been a long weekend for Ian Rappaport.
People are complaining about like the semantics. Like, it's a tweet. The semantics, that's all there is to it. There's not like any sort of like body language or anything involved in it. The words are the only thing that's there. But anyway, what I suppose we're supposed to take from this is that he is reporting that Frank Clark will hold out of training camp if he can't work out a long-term deal with the Seahawks before the July 15th deadline for players who have been franchised by their teams, and that if Clark does play this season on the franchise tag, he would just report at the start of the season.
Okay, so what do you make of, given this offseason, how much money players are getting so far? Frank Clark on the open market is probably worth more than what Frank Clark is looking for the Seahawks.
Yes.
So the Seahawks should just pay Frank Clark.
Or the Seahawks should trade Frank Clark.
What do you feel like would make it worth it for the Seahawks to trade? Look, if they get the Khalil Mack trade, of course they should trade Frank Clark.
I mean, they're not getting the Khalil Mack trade. Like, that's what you would give up to just sign a player is a franchise tag, and that basically never happens. But could they get a first-round pick? I think it's possible they could get a first-round pick. Could they get a second and a third? Maybe.
Is Frank Clark worth a second and third? Well,
I don't know. But I'm saying I would consider that if I were a team that were really short of draft picks.
And what's left of the pass rush, though, without Frank Clark?
I mean, you'd probably want to draft a pass rusher at that point.
I mean, do we consider that Frank Clark is an elite-level pass rusher? Top 10 in the league?
Yeah, probably.
Who are we waiting to pay if we're not paying Frank Clark?
Russell Wilson?
I mean, well, obviously they're going to pay Russell Wilson, and it's going to be a lot. Hmm.
Not everyone thinks that's obvious, for the record.
It has been so well established that basically the places you should pay players are people who pass the ball and people who stop the pass, including pass rushers.
But what if you shouldn't pay anyone? Because it's not just you should pay him, it's the paying him plus the draft picks. This is it's the inverse of the situation. Like, if you thought it was a bad trade for the Seahawks to trade for Sheldon Richardson, because of the fact that you gave up high draft picks and you only had him for 1 year, if you think Frank Clark is going to leave after this year...
What is left of the Seahawks pass rush without Frank Clark?
Deion Jordan, who is an unrestricted free agent himself, for the record. Yeah, there's not a lot. I grant that. You'd have to... I mean, they should have traded for Michael Bennett.
Who's that defensive tackle who was really awesome last year?
Jaron Reed.
It's been a long time since football season.
Really continue our trend of not knowing about stuff about Jaron Reed.
We're in the doldrums of the football season. Do I think that the Seahawks could create a pass rusher who was 80% of Frank Clark via draft picks or whatever? Maybe even just taking somebody who they already have? Maybe.
I mean, I think this is generally considered a pretty good draft for pass rushers.
If they get a first-round pick... they're going to... I don't blame the Seahawks for entertaining the situation. I mean, and they've got until July 15th. Just wait it out.
I mean, first off, you're going to make this trade. You're going to do it before the draft. So they don't have July 15th. They have until next month.
I guess that's true. But I don't see...
It does raise the possibility of another drunken appearance on the Beast Pod. Tasteful Profanity, Beast Pod Production.
I don't think I have plans to be in L.A. on the draft.
Well, you could just wander around the streets of Renton.
Katie's Taco Truck.
Yes.
Walk to Katie's Taco Truck.
Put some time to water to get it operational.
On the day of the draft, I'm working on it. Okay, so it makes sense for them to entertain this. At the same time, I still think they're going to pay Frank Clark, and he's going to be back.
I think if it were that simple that he would have already been signed.
Who has already been signed? What major free agent has already been signed? Who is, like, at the point of being franchised?
I don't know. I don't follow it closely enough to know that off the top of my head.
I just don't.
All right.
I think this is... It's a lot of fuss about something that is ultimately not going to matter.
We'll see. Let's move on to UW Sports.
Hasn't Pete Carroll said Frank Clark will be back? As a matter of fact, it's not like Frank Clark will be back. He was not saying that about Earl Thomas.
It's true, but that could also work as a negotiating ploy. if you are in fact do in fact have some interest in trading him. You don't want to announce to the world, hey, we're trading Frank Clark because we don't want to pay him this much money. Uh-huh. You want to say he's going to be back and then trade him.
Then you end up with a third round pick from the Oakland Raiders. do we feel like the Steelers, people are like, they were really, really dunked on in that situation.
Yeah.
They treated like a 31-year-old wide, very expensive 31-year-old wide receiver.
He's still very expensive. He carries a slightly larger cap.
Well, I guess that's the issue, is how much the Steelers have to pay him. That to me is, I guess, the part that they're really getting swindled. But it's like, I just don't see them. I don't see it as that bad of a situation trading Antonio Brown for a third-round draft pick.
I mean, also, you know, yeah, he's a 31-year-old receiver. How old is Ben Roethlisberger again? Like, their window to win is now.
Yes. I guess I agree that they had to be in win now mode, but, like, I don't know.
I don't think the process is very good there. I have questions. I have issues. All right, UW Sports. Softball, a disappointing 2-2 finish for Husky softball in the Judy Garman Classic in Fullerton. They beat number 21 Auburn 8-6, but then dropped their next two games to number 3 Florida 1-0 and unranked Michigan 4-2 before finishing out with a win over host Cal State Fullerton.
And they are not in Kansas anymore.
That's much worse than mine. They dropped to 6th and 7th in the Coaches in Softball America polls, respectively, at now 16-3 on the young season, and will return to Seattle for the first time this year to host the Husky Classic this weekend against Idaho State.
Return for the first time.
Northern Illinois, Ohio State, and Seattle U.
All right.
You know, women's basketball had a stunning run through the Pac-12 tournament last weekend as in the 11 seed, knocking off number 6 seed Utah 64-54 on Thursday, then a thrilling 68-67 win over number 11 in the country and number 3 seed Oregon State on Friday night before the Cinderella run came to an end in the Pac-12 semifinals with a 72-61 loss to number 7 and number 2 seed Stanford.
Still fairly competitive.
Yeah, no, it was not a blowout by any
stretch. Can't wait till this happens to Husky basketball when they get upset by the Cinderella Cal or whatever.
Oh, no. I mean, if the Huskies get upset by Cal, that's not good news. I guess that would be the semifinals.
Not even an upset.
True. The Huskies became the third double-digit seed to reach the semifinals of the Pac-12 women's tournament. The Friday game in particular was pretty awesome. A tie game. A bit of a gaffe by the Huskies as Hannah Johnson decided to shoot instead of dribbling out the, you know, and waiting to get fouled with a 3-point lead, or a 2-point lead, I think, at that point, allowing the Beavers to tie the game. But then after a timeout to advance the ball, which you can do in the women's game and not in the men's game.
Like, what in the hell?
No, women's college basketball is really fun to watch. They have great rules. Men's college basketball is backwards.
Why can't they adopt these rules to advance the ball?
I assume eventually they'll adopt most of these, but it's
how
because
many
the,
years is eventually?
It's because they don't want to be the NBA. They don't want to be entertaining.
Like, I just do not get that at
Look,
all.
In their day, you didn't advance the ball, and newspapers cost a nickel, and we liked
and
it.
We liked it, yeah.
But, okay, so a tie game, and then get the winning three, the go-ahead three from Missy Peterson, followed by all five players on the court. Dogpiling with.
Weird. I had a moment. I was like, "There's still like a good chunk of time left here."
There sure was. And then Hannah Johnson coming onto the court to celebrate and getting called for a technical foul.
They really celebrated like the clock had run out. That was really something. But this was one of those games where going into that situation, I think Oregon State had a bucket in the paint right before then, where they scored. Yeah.
Pretty easily.
Yeah, maybe the easiest I've seen basically any team score. Game went to overtime, the Huskies would lose by 11.
Yeah, it wasn't going to go great for them.
It's like they had one window to win. And when Missy Peterson throws up that shot, you're just like, no way is that going in.
It was deep.
And it sailed right through. I don't blame them for celebrating.
No.
It was a miraculous shot.
I don't know if anyone would have gotten the reference, but I wanted to make a tweet about Michael Jordan coming down to slap somebody like he did with Malik Monk earlier in the season when he did the same thing for the Hornets in a game that there was still time left on the clock.
He slapped him?
Something like that. It was definitely, if it hadn't been Michael Jordan and the owner had done that, it would have been a big issue.
Yeah, it's on the game.
But it was, and then the post games. Did you watch the post game show on Pac-12 networks where everyone crowded the desk?
Yeah, that was like, no, it was awesome. A moment. It was great that they had their moment. Realistically, you're watching it and you're like, this is Pac-12 women's basketball. There is a top five team waiting for you.
Yeah,
because there's always a top five team waiting.
It's the exact opposite of Pac-12 men's basketball. Yeah. Pac-12 women's basketball. It's so deep. But they still ended up winning as many games in Vegas as they won all conference regular season long.
No, it was great that they had that moment. Like that three, it was awesome. We were all David Crisp for a second.
Yeah, yeah.
It was very cool. And, but otherwise a pretty disappointing season, or maybe an expected season. And just that the program has fallen so much from where they were 2 or 3 years ago.
And last year was certainly expected because the cupboard was left pretty empty. They had a number of injuries. This year it looked in non-conference like they could be a little bit more competitive. I mean, again, the Pac-12 is brutal, so I don't know that, even a 500 season would have been unrealistic, but, maybe 5-13 was what I was thinking as opposed to 2-15. Hopefully, that run in the conference tournament can be a springboard for next season. They lose two seniors, starting guard Jenna Mosier and then Hannah Johnson, who, started a handful of games but primarily came off the bench in the post. And they'll add three 3-star recruits next year. But it might be next year or never for Jody Wynn, I would say, because Amber Melgoza, who's their leading scorer, is going to be a senior, along with Mylonie Henson, one of their other top players. So, there's a lot of pressure to be more competitive next year.
It's going
to
be a while.
We'll see. All right, let's wrap up with UW men's basketball, which concluded Pac-12 regular season play. Survive
the most disappointing 15-3 Pac-12 season.
It really is.
If
you want to have a really disappointing 15-3 Pac-12 season, start 13-1. That's my recommendation. Survived in overtime 81-76 against Oregon State on Thursday before losing their Pac-12 regular season finale 55-47 to Oregon on Saturday on Senior Day. It was a really emotional pregame ceremony marred by the complete inability to make a three-pointer for an entire 40 minutes.
It wasn't just the entire ability to make a three-pointer. It was that in the first probably 15 minutes or so, they were incapable of playing offense at all.
Yeah, they didn't make any twos either.
They had bad process. They couldn't dribble the ball up court.
It was not good.
It's shocking how unable this team is to adjust, especially quickly. Maybe given a halftime, they can adjust, which great, we'll give Hop credit for that. But sometimes you need to adjust on the fly, and Dominic Green can't dribble. At no point, if there's a pressure defense, should Dominic Green be dribbling the ball. You have both Crisp and Jalen Noel, and even Matisse or whatever. If I'm ranking the players who I want to be dribbling the ball up the court, Dominic Green is near the bottom.
What about him versus Hamir Wright? Because Hamir Wright was also doing a lot of ball handling when Oregon pressed.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, though. It's you need to recognize if there's a full court press, and teams see this. Teams see what happens, and they realize...
But not that many teams do see this, honestly.
If we're in a tournament scenario, which the Huskies will be in this week, teams are going to be throwing the kitchen sink at them.
Perhaps.
They're going to see a press.
They're not going to have that much time to prepare for the Huskies because of the fact that, is a team that gets a bye. The Huskies face every game will be against a team that played the previous day by definition.
I suppose that's great. Don't know how to full court press?
My sixth grade
basketball team was able to do it.
Were they?
Do you think that whomever they're playing in the Pac-12 will not be
capable? It was illegal, though. We couldn't defend in the backcourt.
Ugh, you played in a different league.
I guess maybe that's true.
I was in the YMCA, not the Boys and Girls Club.
Okay. the wide open, free-flowing YMCA.
We won all of our games by 50 points. Do you remember this team?
I don't think I do.
It was stacked. We had Michael Roddy, Brandon Newnham. Come on.
These are great references and call-outs for Chris Smith and no one else.
Michael Roddy, Brandon Newnham, Big John Nizzle, me and Chris Smith. Yeah. That team was deep.
Okay.
pretty, I mean, I came off the bench. It was like basically the only time in elementary school that I came off the bench.
Wow. Can you imagine?
Anyway, this team is so incapable. I feel like they're incapable of playing against a defense. They can play against man-to-man defense, and that's it. Or maybe not even that.
So if you break down Pac-12 play into the two halves, the first nine games and the second nine games, and I didn't even split it at the 10-0 start in the final eight games, because, you know, that's a little more arbitrary. Like, by definition, if you've won all your games, you're going to be better. But the first nine games of conference play, the Huskies had a 114 offensive rating. The last nine games of conference play, they had a 102 offensive rating.
So what happened?
Well, they stopped making threes. The first nine games of conference play, they shot 42% from three after shooting 31% on threes in non-conference play. Then they shot 34% on threes during the second half of non-conference play. The defense did not decline quite as much. They had an 89 defensive rating in the first half of conference play, a 95 defensive rating the second half.
Which is better.
No, that's worse. You want to allow fewer points.
Okay.
But, like, if you rank where they were in those two halves, their defense was the best. They had the best defensive rating both in the first half and the second half.
Okay.
But they had the best offensive rating in the first half and were ninth in the second half.
Oh, God.
The other thing that stands out, the three-point differential in terms of percentage.
What is happening?
The first half of conference play, they shot 42% on threes, and opponent shot 29%. The second half of conference play, they shot 34% on threes. Opponents shot 34.5%.
Wow.
So it turns out maybe three-point shooting is random. Is there? I don't know. God, weird.
You fucking revel in this every year. Every year. Like, God damn it. Why does this happen?
I mean, you say, why does this happen? Why did it happen that they were so good the first nine games? Like, enjoy that. Like, that's the good
thing. It's over. We've got nothing to enjoy left. The whole season is over.
This is way too fatalistic. I mean,
like, okay, oh, they're going to make the tournament, and they're just going to lose to whoever they play.
It's a one-game scenario. It's like they couldn't get that good ramen.
Conference player of the year can shoot, like, 3 of 16. Come on.
The other team.
We know what's happening here.
The other team could come up with a show you ramen.
There's only one show you ramen on that court. And that's the Washington Huskies.
Oh, man. Oh,
because their offense is not spicy at all.
That is very fair.
It's just like, but this game against Oregon, I really felt like they fought for it. Like,
yeah, the effort was terrific.
It was a classic. Like, we have people, as people who have watched a lot of basketball games, there are these games where it's just like, you can't win. Like, you can fight so hard and you just get to that point over and over and over again, and you can't get over it. Like, I mean, for whatever reason. And, like, a lot of it was luck. We saw that three that Oregon hit that lost the game, end of the game.
I mean, Lewis King.
It was luck. They hit a lot of shots.
He literally threw it in. He was not, like, it was not a normal shooting motion. He literally threw it in. Even Dana Ullman said as much after the game.
And there were some moments where it's like a wide open Dominic Green three or something. It was like, if any of these go in, it's a completely different scenario. But in these types of games, you just can't win these types of games. Like, that's what this was, and it happened to come at a time that if they could have pulled off this victory, they'd be in a very good position. But now my question for you is, do they need to win a game in the Pac-12 tournament?
So I would say probably not. Most people, including my ESPN colleague John Gassaway, put them in the lock category after they beat Oregon State. There's still an 8 in ESPN's bracketology from Joe Lunardi. Like, they're not a bubble team right now.
Okay.
Now,
Arizona State's a bubble team.
Yes. Obviously, things can change. I think also one thing that should be noted, like, everyone is making the comparison to 2012 for obvious reasons. Besides for the fact that the Huskies, A, had a better non-conference performance, B, had a better record ultimately in conference play at 15-3 as opposed to 14-4. But I think the other important thing is, like, I think part of what happened in 2012 is the committee looked at it and said, the Pac-12 is not a three-bid league. Colorado is in as the automatic qualifier, winning the Pac-12 tournament. And at that point, Cal was ahead of UW as an at-large, despite finishing a game
Cal
back.
Cal got the at-large bid, despite being second in the Pac-12.
Yeah, I mean, because they had a much stronger non-conference and didn't lose to the eighth seed in the first round of the Pac-12 tournament. All of those things happened. But this year, there is no Cal.
Okay.
Arizona State is clearly behind UW in the pecking order. The only way they could get ahead of UW in the pecking order is to win the Pac-12 tournament.
Which would have to play each other in the final.
No, I mean they wouldn't have to, but at that point they would be the automatic qualifiers, so it would still be a two-bid
league. But the only way that they get ahead of UW in the pecking order is by beating UW in the Pac-12 tournament, and they would have to face each other
probably
in the final.
I don't think even that does it. Like, they're pretty far apart right now.
Sure. Okay. But I'm saying the Huskies would get to the final in that scenario.
Yes. So I think they're probably in, but it would be nice to not test that by losing early in the Pac-12 tournament. That's my recommendation.
Okay, so can we run through the teams that they could possibly play?
Yes. Although first, before we get there, should we talk about the Pac-12 awards?
Sham!
Wow. You're that upset about Jalen Noel being named Conference Player of the Year?
I'm just upset about the season. It's not about Jalen Noel being...
I mean, Matisse Thybulle deserved it.
Rarely has there been... maybe this is not true. This might be the case a lot. Rarely has there been a Pac-12 Player of the Year where I kind of think they're bad. Like, not even, like they're not great. Like, I just kind of think that they're bad.
Jalen Noel is not bad.
Jalen Noel is...
I mean, he had a very efficient scoring conference season.
No, Jalen Noel's good. I'm frustrated about how bad he played in the first half. And he actually played quite well in the second half.
It's like one half, man.
Against Oregon. It's just, that game was so frustrating.
It was a very frustrating
game. We got accustomed to winning. Jalen Noel's good. I take it back.
But Matisse Thybulle should have been the Conference Player of the Year. Like, he's the most important player to the Huskies' success.
It's like, not even existed on offense. We're frustrated with everybody here.
Defense exists too.
Defense does exist, and Matisse made some plays, but like
he made a lot of plays. Thybulle did repeat his Conference Defensive Player of the Year, as just like Mike Hopkins did as Coach of the Year for a second consecutive year. Every single year Mike Hopkins has coached, he has been the Coach of the Year of the Pac-12.
I hate this team.
And as I always say, regression to the mean is a myth, so Mike Hopkins will always win Coach of the Year every single year from here on out.
But okay, defense matters, and to be an elite defensive player is very important.
And the Huskies are a way better defensive team than they are an offensive team, so you should probably reward their most important defensive player.
It's really tough to give the Player of the Year award to somebody who...
doesn't average double figures.
What did he average?
I think 9.2 points per game.
Just a non-factor on offense.
But he was efficient. Like,
I could see him in the NBA becoming a pretty solid catch-and-shoot focus on defense player, like a two guard. You think he's a two guard in the NBA?
Probably, although he'll defend multiple positions.
I could see him becoming a pretty solid catch and shoot player who's like defends the best player on whatever team every game.
Yeah.
And that's a great place for Matisse Thybulle to be.
It is.
He is not an offensive creator in any way.
Still an outside chance of sneaking into the first round. Wouldn't be surprised.
I mean, John Hollinger was at the game on Saturday, right?
There were several scouts there. Mike Dunleavy Jr. was there.
Are they there ostensibly to see Matisse? Or,
I mean, obviously you pick that particular game because Oregon does have some interesting longer-term players. Lewis King was pretty highly regarded coming into the season, but hasn't had a great freshman year. Have heard more Jalen Noel NBA buzz lately, although still at this point, you know, I think second round, if that. It's not just for Matisse Thybulle, but he was probably the player they're most interested in seeing.
What are the chances at this point? Jalen's going to declare. We know that, right?
Well, I mean, he should declare because there's really no downside to it at this point.
What do we think the chances are that he's back next year? Less than 50%?
It's tough to handicap and ask me again after they conclude postseason play. Because, like, if he has a couple big games in the NCAA tournament, if that happens, then that changes things dramatically.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay.
This very... a couple of good games? You're implying that they would play multiple NCAA tournament games. This team that is...
47th in KenPom?
47th in KenPom.
No. They're not very good.
Can't handle Trace Tinkle. But they're going to...
You need to put some respect on Trace Tinkle's name.
What about... what's the Pritchard guy's name? Is his name
Peyton Pritchard?
Peyton Pritchard. Can't handle Peyton Pritchard.
That's less good, but Peyton Pritchard is also... you know.
Like, it's multiple NCAA tournament games. That is a joke.
You're well, saying
if,
that, like...
If I'm at South by Southwest and sign Radiohead, you know?
You're talking about how I'm, like, the taking glee in the three-point shooting not being sustainable. But I have more hope about this team than you do because of the fact that I didn't overrate them in the first place. You can't be as disappointed if you didn't have high hopes. Life philosophy right there. That's my win forever. Okay, anyway, the first round on Thursday at noon Pacific time.
Is that when this game's happening?
Yeah, 2 p.m. Central for you and only you. The Huskies will face the winner of Wednesday's matchup between Arizona and USC. Arizona finished ninth in the Pac-12. It is their worst finish since going 1-17 in 1982-83, the season before they hired Lute Olson. After a 5-1 start to conference play, they went 3-9 the rest of the way and finished with the Pac-12's 10th best offensive rating. So this is not your dad's Arizona. This is not your older brother's Arizona. This is not last year's Arizona.
Pretty incredible.
Sean Miller embattled, had to deny at practice this week that he was saying goodbye to Arizona fans after senior day when he talked about having 10 great years there, as he has been subpoenaed to appear
gone.
As part of
Sean Miller. This could be the last game that Sean Miller coaches. Well, at Arizona.
Yes.
I'm sure Pepperdine or whatever. Not Pepperdine.
Yeah, not Pepperdine. Hey, shouts to Lorenzo Romar getting Pepperdine to the semifinals of the West Coast Conference.
They lose to Gonzaga.
Yeah, they lose to Gonzaga. They were down 40 at one point. Here's the good news. You got to the semifinals. Here's the bad news. Now you have to play Gonzaga. They made it a very respectable 28.
He's going to be the head coach of like UCSB or something.
I think he'd go back east. USC also started well, 5-2. And
if he's not arrested.
Slumped, losing 8 of their last 11 games in their last 4 games of Pac-12 play, 3 of those coming on the road. But would say they're a little better than their record in terms of Pac-12 net rating. They outscored opponents by 1.9 points per 100 possessions, which ranks 7th in the conference.
Which puts them at, like, would be a pretty solid, like, Big Sky team.
Slightly better than that. It's like middle of the pack, Mountain West.
47.
It's like good enough to get upset by Pepperdine in the West Coast Conference quarterfinals. Yes.
Oh my God, we're so bad.
And that's the scary thing is like the Huskies are not a lock to advance.
Oh no.
They're like
we've talked about this a lot. There is no game, there is no team that they could possibly face in the Pac-12 tournament. Granted, we know who they are going to be, but they could have any team. 1 through 2 or 2 through 12, I would think that they'd have a pretty solid chance to lose to any of them.
I mean, they've lost to Cal. Ken Pomeroy gives them a 68% chance of winning their opening game against either USC or Arizona. A 43% chance of advancing to the final and a 26% chance of winning the Pac-12 tournament, highest among any teams. Oregon, the second rated team by Ken Pom. Second in this at 18% chance of winning the championship.
Wow, 18%?
Yeah, and maybe the one piece of good news is that Oregon is the 6th seed, is on the other side of the bracket, because the Ducks are legitimately good.
Oregon's actually good. And should that make us feel better about that loss on Saturday?
To some extent.
What about beating Wazoo by like a point? Where does losing to Cal fit into this?
That does not fit into it, as it turns out.
So Oregon is clearly a pretty good team. Like
they are.
It was a sluggish game, and it was frustrating, but they should have lost Oregon twice this year. So
and still the 6th seed in the Pac-12 tournament somehow. So the Huskies, and if they advance to the semifinals, will face either Oregon State, who's the 4 seed, Colorado, who's the 5, or Cal, who's the 12 seed. They could face them at the semis. You know, it would be a pretty close to an even matchup between Oregon State and Colorado, assuming Colorado does, in fact, advance here.
Please, Colorado.
I'm a little more worried about Colorado than you are, because Tyler Bay, who won Pac-12 Most Improved Player honors, he got it going against the Huskies in the second half.
Trace
Tingle they found
is
something.
The most frightening player that the Huskies can face in this tournament.
Yeah, because he's the best player in the Pac-12, other than Matisse Thybulle.
Yeah, that's why you don't want to face him.
But Oregon State still is not that good overall.
Just in a tournament scenario, you don't want to face the best player in the tournament.
Probably true. I mean, look, they're...
Do you not know what Oregon State means?
The Beavs have had a tendency to play the Huskies well and to play all those games in overtime.
They almost won that game on a like crazy Thompson three. I don't even know which one it was.
It was Stevie, who has only won two games against the Huskies.
That shot almost went in.
Mike Kopke has had a pretty good reaction to that. No one asked him in the press conference. I asked the last question, asked him about like Stevie Thompson getting another look at a three, and he was like, "Yeah, I was terrified." And then obviously, if the Huskies advance, the entire other side of the bracket would be a potential opponent in the championship game. Arizona State's the 2 seed. Utah is the 3 seed, had a strong conference tournament, but is given just the 6th best chances of winning the tournament by Ken Pomeroy's metrics, in large part because of their weak non-conference and also because of the fact that they would match up with Oregon in the second round, assuming Oregon holds off Wazoo. And then... let's see. So Oregon, UCLA, also on that side of the bracket. That's pretty much all the Pac-12 teams.
Okay. Well, if they get there, it would be great to win. If not, whatever. Just make the freaking tournament. and not be an 11 seed. I don't really think that's in play, but just win a game.
Yes. Just don't make a sweat out selection Sunday.
Oh my God. At least they did Selection Sunday. I don't think I was in town for it last year. I definitely didn't watch. They did it alphabetically last year.
Yeah, I guess that is what they did. I don't know what the plan is this year.
No, it's to go back to the old school.
Okay,
because that means that we would have to wait until like the very end.
That is accurate.
Oh my God. Well, I guess we're lucky that that's not happening. But just like win a game.
I also advise that.
Or, you know what, win it all and just know that you're going to be in.
It would be useful. It would be.
Is that so much to ask?
That would be nice.
Like, why? I just don't get why the offense was so bad all of a sudden. But I suppose it's a make or miss sport.
Or the offense was always this bad and they just covered it up with some fluky three-point shooting in the first half.
Let's get some of that action again.
I mean, in a four-game tournament, or a three-game tournament, anything could happen.
All right.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.